Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us Scott Wolf, president and managing director at American Securities. He's here to talk to us about the private equity firm's investment strategy, as well as its industrials portfolio and M&A trends in the sector for 2025. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Great. So let's start with your career. Tell us about how you ended up at American Securities. My understanding is you were in Chicago before that at Merrill Lynch.
Yeah, that's correct. I started my career in M&A investment banking specifically, and it was generalists across different industries. After 3 years of doing that, I got to know various private equity firms as we were selling companies to them. And it sounded really interesting to me to be on the buy side and to be an investor. And I also wanted the opportunity to move to New York and try that out for at least a couple of years. And so I interviewed a number of firms and I found a great fit at American Securities. And so I joined the firm as an associate in 2002. At the time, we were investing our third fund, which was a $650 million fund with about 13 investment professionals. And it was a great fit. For 2 years, I was there as an associate. Then I left to go to business school at Wharton and came back as a vice president in 2006.
And obviously, your roles changed over those two decades. And I'm curious to know if you've always focused on industrials as you do now at the firm. How did things evolve over time?
Yeah, first, it was more of a generalist experience. And I can talk a little bit more later, maybe about what American Securities focuses on from an industry perspective. But the associate role and really the early vice president role was very focused on execution. How do you actually execute on a deal and really all aspects from diligence to financing to the actual purchase agreement? And so there was, that was the number one goal then. And probably about 2 years after coming back from business school, I started to really dedicate all my time to industrials and then eventually found a niche within specialty chemicals, which is probably about 2/3 of my time today as part of the industrials vertical.
So speaking of the firm, the most interesting thing for me is that it started as a family office and then evolved over time. Tell us a little bit about that history and how that informs what the firm does today.
Sure. We grew out of a family office. The Rosenwald family started the office in the 1940s. They were some of the original Sears Roebuck investors and operators at Sears Roebuck. And they started the office to invest the family wealth across a range of different asset classes. Early private equity was one of those. And eventually, they started to formalize the first private equity fund and bring out outside investors in the mid-90s. And the original fund was about a $70 million fund. And today, with over $27 billion of capital under management, we've diversified our investor base quite a bit. But those early investors still influence how we think about investing today.
That family focus has obviously remained at the firm, especially when you look at the kind of companies that you partner with and invest in. Talk to us a little bit about that checklist when you're looking at platform investments.
Sure. You think about those early family investors, they were highly focused on capital preservation. They had created generational wealth. And of course, they wanted to make returns, but at the same time, not losing money was critical. And so you think about what we focus on today, those early investors still influence our philosophy. And the types of businesses we tend to look for are market-leading businesses, but probably more important than market-leading businesses, they tend to have some differentiated factor we can point to that we think will allow them to maintain their market position. It could be intellectual property, manufacturing know-how, sometimes a long-term contract, but something to say, here's what the business is doing today and why we think it will continue to have its position going forward. We find those opportunities across a wide range of different industries, but that's the unifying theme and what we look for.
And the other bit is you follow these companies for quite a bit of time because you want to know that you would be the best fit for them and vice versa. Talk to us about that sort of right to win strategy that you have.
Yeah, I mean, that starts with the sector focus. So it's one thing to say we invest in industrials, but underneath industrials, we have specific expertise in chemicals, building products, power and energy transition, and niche manufacturing businesses. And we have partners focused on each of those areas. And they've been, myself included, we've been focused on those areas for oftentimes well over a decade. And that means developing banker relationships, executive relationships, knowing the specialty consultants in the space, going to and speaking at conferences. And so we develop themes within those subsectors and we get to know businesses, whether those are CEOs, directors, owners, and we have a long list of businesses that we target. And targeting them is one thing, but actually having a value creation thesis is more important. So as we get to know those businesses, we develop a value creation thesis, and we then hopefully either become the right partner to the team that's there, to the owners that are selling, or eventually are the winning buyer because we have a differentiated right to win given that value creation opportunity.
And is there sort of a EBITDA range that you typically target for your investments?
Yeah, so we target $50 to $200 million of EBITDA. Now, I'd say we're willing to go a little bit lower than that if we find the right platform where we see opportunities for follow-on investments. And you know, many companies in the portfolio have grown to be well over the $200 million of EBITDA, but going in for a new platform, it's in that $50 to $200 million of EBITDA.
Got it. And given the amount of work you put in ahead of time before investing in a company, it's a very selective process, is what I understand. You don't do more than 3 to 4 platforms a year?
We don't have a hard rule on the number of platforms, but the average is something in that 3 to 4 range. We really want to focus on those businesses where we have that right to win because we think we see an opportunity to add value that others may not see. And those don't come around all the time. And so we have to be patient to find those right opportunities.
And the other bit that's also interesting is the resources group that the firm has. Tell us more about how that's set up. It's a pretty sizable group, like 50 plus members in it. Tell us more about how it supports investments.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's a big part of our value creation strategy. So I mentioned the focus on capital preservation, and that's part of the strategy. But obviously, just preserving capital doesn't create returns for our investors. And so when we find those right opportunities in the industry groups that we focus on, a big part of the value creation is that resources group. And so the investment team today is about a little over 40 individuals focused on sourcing, diligencing, and working with our management teams at the board level. And the resources group, as you mentioned, is over 50 people. And those are all full-time American Securities employees. They're functional experts in areas like strategy, operations, procurement, IT, human capital, data science, recruiting, FP&A, pricing. We have an office in Shanghai that's helping our companies think about Asia strategy and Asia sourcing. And those are resources that we offer up for free to our management teams if and when desired by the teams. And it's a group that didn't exist when I joined in 2002, and it's grown to be more than 50 people because we've seen the value that they add across the portfolio.
And there's sort of a generalist and a specialist aspect to that team. Can some of the members support a specific investment in a certain industry, or is there more of the general operational stuff that goes into every single investment?
Yeah, so the approach we take is a functional approach. So we don't really have industry experts. Mm-hmm. We find functional experts, so people who have decades of procurement experience, and they can use that procurement experience across different industries. Now, of course, we don't apply 50 people to every company. That would be a problem for us to manage, as well as for our companies to manage. And so early on in a new investment, we work with the management team to create what we call a shared vision plan. And it's really a medium-term strategic plan. It's the 5 opportunities that we all believe will create value during our ownership. That then becomes the agenda for board meetings. That's what we're talking about strategically all the time. And we try to fit our resources group individuals into those opportunities to help drive value. And we don't have to have somebody for each of those 5, but we try to figure out where we can fit in to support teams. And we very much have a partnership approach with our management team. So it's really supporting them versus taking over any function.
Absolutely. And coming back to industrials and the sort of specific niches that you and your colleagues focus on, I'd love to know a little bit more about what makes those subsectors interesting. Obviously, we could start with chemicals because that is your focus and how you found that niche. So I'd love to know a little bit more about the trends that make specialty chemicals an attractive investment opportunity.
Sure. Well, if I go back to our first investment in chemicals, which was in 2008, we bought a business called Monsanto Envirochem Systems, MECS. I won't spend a lot of time talking about that business, but they design 70% of the world's sulfuric acid plants, and they provide products that go into that. And it was really our first chemical investment, but it fit well with the types of differentiated businesses that we were looking for, and there was lots of growth opportunities. I took that upon myself then to say, this is interesting. There's probably other stuff in chemicals, and started developing more relationships with bankers and executives, and that led to a business called General Chemical that we bought in 2009, Arizona Chemical 2010. But what we found within chemicals is, first of all, chemicals touches almost everything. And so there's a broad range of different chemistries of different end markets that chemicals are going into. But probably most importantly, we found that specialty chemicals in particular really fit that differentiated model that we were looking for, where you would develop a solution for a customer. So it wasn't just selling a chemical. It was understanding a coating company or at a adhesive company, or understanding a ag company and what were their needs and developing a solution for them. And once you did that, it was hard to be replaced, led to high margins, led to some level of pricing power. And those were the businesses that we were looking to buy. We found lots of those within chemicals, again, across a wide range of different end markets. And then over time, what we found is our resources group became more and more familiar with chemical companies, in particular on operations, procurement, pricing. And so we found lots of ways that we could use our resources to add value post-close, working in partnership with the management teams of those companies.
Now, building products, energy, niche industrial manufacturing, that's something that you don't necessarily focus on as much as some of your other colleagues, but curious to know more about those as well, if there's any sort of commonality between those subsectors that made them an interesting specialty for American Securities or anything else that drives that investment thesis.
Yeah, so at the highest level, I would say it's something similar. It's where we think we can find those differentiated businesses within those areas, but we don't just focus on everything in each of those areas, and every chemical company, every building products company, or it has to be a level deeper, two or three levels deeper as to what themes do we think are most attractive. And we've consistently found themes and companies in those other areas that you mentioned that we found to be attractive. You know, you think about something like a power and energy transition. Today, we're seeing increasing demand in power, largely in the US, largely driven by data centers and driven by AI, really. And we're unlikely to buy a data center. That's not really what we do. But what we're seeing is opportunities in aftermarket parts and maintenance activity and testing equipment around those that increase in power. And our team is deep in that space and is looking at those opportunities and following that theme. You know, for things like testing equipment, which is, you know, regulatory driven or mission critical to the data centers themselves, you can find differentiated businesses that are hard to displace. Building products, we find differentiated businesses with technology. We owned a business called Henry Company, which was the leader in roof mastics, and mastics are there to repair roofs. And if you think about repairing, you have a leak in your roof, you're likely to repair it. And they have a technology and product that is the market leader in that space. And that we found that to be a differentiated brand. And so those are the types of opportunities we're finding across those different verticals.
Absolutely. And so I do want to dig more into some of the portfolio companies, especially the ones you're involved in, starting with like Hexion, where I think that is one of the examples of your right to win strategy, because you followed it for a long time. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about how that investment came about.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. You're right. Hexion is a great example of a business that we followed for multiple years and we're excited about when we made the investment and had a thesis going in. And you know, we first looked at Hexion in 2016, I believe it was. At that point, Hexion owned multiple businesses. We were looking at a specific piece of the portfolio, which was their wood resins business, which is basically an adhesive that's binding boards together that's going into housing, other construction activity. And they're a leader in that space. And then we had a thesis that housing would continue to grow and that they had given their market share of opportunities to continue to expand value. Unfortunately, in 2016, we weren't successful in buying the business. We couldn't get to a price that worked for the company and they didn't sell. But we kept in contact with the team, with the CEO. Over a few years, they ended up selling off some of the pieces of the portfolio that weren't interesting to us. And by maintaining contact, by keeping up to date on the business and what we thought was a value creation opportunity, we were able to eventually buy the business in 2022. And 2+ years in, over 2.5 years in now, things are going really well. The company is growing both in terms of volumes as well as earnings improvement, given that it's now under a single ownership, really focusing on growth and opportunities to drive value.
And you also made a recent add-on acquisition for Hexion, if I'm not mistaken, and that kind of added that recurring revenue piece that we talked about. Can you tell us more about that as well?
Yeah, we recently closed on an acquisition called SmartTech. And SmartTech is really a technology-based play that's very complementary to Hexion. It's giving us technology, AI-driven in certain ways, to help our customers be even more efficient. So helping them utilize less material to increase throughput on their lines. And by using that, while also supplying them product, I think we become more entrenched with those customers and hopefully create that recurring revenue stream because of that customer intimacy.
For sure. And are more acquisitions in the pipeline for the platform? Are you constantly evaluating those?
We have a great team at Hexion, and we are constantly evaluating new opportunities. Nothing that's imminent, but we do have a large pipeline of things we're considering at the moment.
And another place you love, adhesives. You've had two investments in that space. So if we could start with Royal Adhesives, because that's something that you exited. I'd love to know a little bit more about that. What an investment's life cycle looks like under American Securities through Royal's lens.
Yeah, happy to talk about that. When you think about our theme development, adhesives is a really good example. About over 10 years ago, as we were thinking about themes within chemicals, we said adhesives are a really interesting area. Adhesives are replacing mechanical fasteners in construction activity, in cars, in aerospace. You know, the amount of adhesive that goes into a car is about 1,000% from where it was a decade ago, maybe more, and it has to do with lightweighting, with bonding different materials. And we also saw it as a fragmented market where there's lots of really interesting small companies that can benefit by coming together and cross-selling different technologies, benefiting from procurement opportunities. And we probably looked for 2 to 3 years at a number of adhesive companies that we either decided not to buy or in some cases were outbid. And then we came across Royal, which had been on our target list for a while, and we were successful in buying Royal and followed that playbook. We made a number of acquisitions. We improved procurement using our resources group and did other things to drive value. It's actually a little bit different than our typical investment that we ended up selling it in just over 2 years, which is a short time frame for us. And that was largely because what we created was really interesting to a number of strategic buyers. And so after a couple of years, we started receiving calls from those strategic buyers and determined that the best thing for us to do for our investors was to pursue that strategic sale. That said, when we sold it, we were still really excited about adhesives. So we continued to pursue new opportunities. And after a number of years, we were successful in buying Meridian Adhesives in 2022, so a couple of years ago, and are excited to build that platform to repeat something similar.
And the strategic exit for Royal, when companies were kind of reaching out to acquire the business, were they looking at it as, were they also adhesives businesses, or were they like doing other sorts of chemicals and saw Royal as a complementary fit to their business?
Yeah, the strategists we talked to on Royal were all in adhesives already, and they were looking to continue to grow their platform by buying something of scale. So they had very clear synergies to buy it.
Got it. And have you done any add-ons for Meridian yet, or are those again under something that you're evaluating right now?
No, we have. We actually completed an acquisition the day we bought it in 2022, and then we recently completed another acquisition of a part of the Meridian portfolio is within electronics. We completed an Asian electronics acquisition late last year. So, and we continue to have a lot of opportunities in our pipeline for Meridian today.
Imagine this is case by case, but I'm curious to know if those add-ons usually take the shape of geographic expansion, adding different product offerings, or that something else altogether that's necessary for these businesses.
In some ways, it's all of the above. Yes. So sometimes it is a geographic expansion. In this case, we're looking to grow our Asian electronics presence, and this gave us an opportunity to do that. We last year also bought a business in the UK to expand our European presence. And then the opportunity that I mentioned that we bought when we closed was to get into a new end market. Actually, it was a HVAC adhesive business that was complementary. So it could be a new market, it could be a new geography, or it could just be a new technology.
We love our HVAC here at the Deal. Well, I do. I read about it so much. And then the last portfolio company that I wanted to talk about, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Vibrant, that came together with three different companies as a platform. Could you talk more about that as well?
Sure. Yeah, you're correct. It was three different companies. Maybe just a little history there to just kind of bring it all together. We looked at buying a public company called Faro back in 2000. in 16, you know, maybe around the same time as Hexion deal we talked about before. Yeah, we made an offer to the board, but it wasn't enough there for the board to transact. But we, you know, similar to Hexion, kept in contact with the CEO of the Faro business over the years. One of Faro's acquisition targets was a company called ChromaFlow. And after we moved on from Faro, later in 2016, we ended up buying ChromaFlow, which is a liquid colorants business. They make color that goes into architectural and industrial paints and coatings, you know, global leader in that space. Later, we bought a business called Prince. It had some similarities to ChromaFlow, but was different enough that we weren't planning on bringing those businesses together. They were a minerals-based business, providing especially minerals and chemicals into a number of different markets, battery, porcelain enamel, construction, ag, and some others. We kept in contact with the Faro CEO, as I mentioned, and Faro, in a lot of ways, was half Prince, half ChromaFlow. But then they had another large business, which wasn't a fit for either one. And they eventually decided to sell their, what they call their tile coatings business. And that was a catalyst for us to really push forward Faro board and CEO to say we're interested in bringing those businesses together. And in 2021, we signed an agreement to take Faro private and bring all three businesses together. It took us a while to close because there were some regulatory divestitures we had to get through, but eventually brought all three businesses together to create Vibrance.
Always playing the long game. What's the strategy there? What's next for Vibrance under American Securities?
Yeah, so we spent our first year plus really bringing three businesses together. Right? Culturally, hard to bring three companies together that in their own right, were all market leaders in their space and all sizable global businesses. We also, during that time, focused on synergy capture. There was a lot of synergies related to procurement, to plant consolidation, some SG&A to bring all those businesses together. And so that was really the focus. Then after that was done really, really well, the team at Vibrance did a great job bringing those three businesses together with support from a lot of people in the resources group. We have moved, you know, to solely focus on growth. And some of that is growing market share in our existing businesses. We're also building two new plants for new products. One is a Pearls technology, which is a new colorant technology. We're building a plant right now in the Netherlands. And then we're building a high purity manganese sulfate plant in Mexico, which is a product that goes into EV technology, into EV batteries. And we'll be the sole North American producer of that product, which we expect will be in high demand.
Absolutely. And talking of general M&A trends in the industrial space, are there any factors that you're keeping an eye on for 2025? Things that you think need to maybe change for there to be higher volume in transactions?
The number one thing we're thinking about right now is industrial volumes.
Yeah.
Yeah, what we've seen broadly in industrials, and again, there's lots of different subsectors, so I'm going to talk at a very high level. You have to go sector by sector. But at a high level, we've seen volumes being really slow to recover, continue to be soft. Yeah, we're seeing that in some of our businesses. But we're also seeing that in a lot of the businesses that we're thinking about buying. And I think that's causing a lot of would-be sellers to sit on the sideline. It's probably causing us and other buyers to be cautious on valuations given the uncertainty. And while there's, I think, a lot of pent-up supply of businesses that will be sold, we haven't quite seen a full recovery in those actually being actionable right now, despite us trying and, again, targeting ones where we have a right to win. And it's still a little bit slow right now in the new deal activity.
So valuation expectations remain high still among sellers.
Yeah, again, there's differences among some opportunities out there, but in general, I'd say valuation expectations remain very high and buyers continue to be relatively cautious. And I think if we look at our pipeline from 2024 of all the opportunities we looked at, something like 2/3 of them didn't transact.
Wow.
You know, that might be in any given year, normal year, that probably be something like 20% or 25%. And last year being 2/3 just means a lot of it was related to not finding a meeting of the minds on valuation. I don't recall the exact number, but that number is also fairly high in 2023 for similar reasons.
And speaking more specifically about some of the subsectors you focus on, specialty chemicals, I think we talked about this the last time we spoke. There's rumors going around about sizable businesses, you know, 100 million, 200 million EBITDA plus businesses being in the market. But you are taking a bit of a contrarian view and saying that doesn't really necessarily mean transaction volumes are going to improve in 2025. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are around that.
I think 2024 was relatively light, so it's possible that things will improve in 2025. And yeah, we are seeing opportunities, right? So saying activity is light doesn't mean there are no opportunities. And we have a couple of $100 million plus opportunities in the pipeline today. I'd also say we've seen a couple of those that were in market over the last, you know, number of months that actually didn't transact because they didn't find buyers that met the reservation price. So I do think there'll be activity. I mean, one thing we are seeing, which is interesting in chemicals, is you think about some of the large strategics, public companies, they're always pruning their portfolios, you know, sometimes becoming more diversified, sometimes becoming more focused. And that means there are always some opportunities out there. And of course, those strategics care a lot about value, but if they have a strategic imperative to narrow the focus, they may be willing to sell to do that because that's what they've promised their investors. And so you'll see some of those opportunities. And we are thinking about some of those today. But I don't know if that means it's going to be a broad-based activity in chemicals in 2025.
I'm curious to know specifically about the other subsectors as well in industrials. Are there any expectations that you have over there in terms of transaction volumes? Do you think things might be better in, say, building products compared to specialty chemicals or energy, anything else?
Yeah, I would say energy is the one we see more active today because there is a clear view on demand growth in energy. And our team has been following that deeply. And so I think we're seeing more there in that sector right now. Now, one of the things we didn't talk about is probably about 40% of what we've done historically has been from founder or family-owned or operated businesses. And within our, when we talked about sort of the niche industrial manufacturing businesses, we find a lot of those opportunities there. And so those are interesting because they don't always follow the same patterns in terms of activity levels. It tends to be more, you know, founder or family specific. They may have a reason that it makes sense to sell that's different than whatever's going on in the business. And so we probably have a dozen of those that we're following. And I think some of those will become actionable in 2025. We're also seeing, we didn't really talk about it, but we focused on industrials today. A large part of our firm is focused on services, whether those IT services, government services, some healthcare services. And we are seeing a lot of activity in those areas at the moment as well.
Within services, curious to know a little, because we do a lot of facility services, residential services, things like that. Where is the interest among the ones that you kind of mentioned between IT services, government services, or facility services? Where are you seeing the most interest?
Yeah, well, in particular, IT services and government services, we have individuals, partners focused in those areas. We made several investments in IT services, most recently NWN and Trace3. And we see lots of opportunities in there in those businesses, some of it driven by AI. And you know, these are businesses that are providing services to corporates or municipalities in some cases. And given this changing landscape, there's lots of consistent demand for their services and products. As it relates to our government services team, we spend a lot of time in aerospace and defense and had a business Momentum that we merged with in a Reverse Morris Trust with a division of Jacobs, which is now a publicly traded company. There, we're seeing continued opportunities for growth within the government and with specialized services where, you know, think about the differentiation and think about the capital preservation. You tend to have long-term contracts where you can very clearly understand your cash flows for the coming years. And we continue to look for new opportunities in that space.
I kind of want to end this podcast with the family founder owned focus again, because that is something I feel like is very interesting of late to a lot of investors and to us as reporters as well. There's just seems to be like this generational succession that everyone is waiting for to happen. And when you talked about industrial manufacturing and how that is something that you're seeing there, how do you approach those conversations with families and founders? Obviously, you're targeting businesses that are a lot bigger. So I imagine they're more professional and it might be easier, but curious to know, because a lot of them aren't very readily willing to sell to private equity. So how do those conversations pan out?
A lot of it, I think, is the value proposition about how we can help them as a partner. And that partnership approach is really important. And a couple of different ways we think about that. One is, you know, the family office history that we talked about earlier, I think matters there because we have some commonality. I think more importantly, the resources group resonates really well with those founders because they see that we're there to not take over their business, but to support them with resources that they may or may not have had access to historically. The other thing we do is when we meet a new founder and we think we're going to be moving forward together, you know, we give them the reference list for every CEO we've worked with in the past. And we tell them, you know, feel free to call anybody on the list. And, you know, it's easy for me to say we work really well with, you know, as a partner to management teams and to founder-owned businesses. It's another thing for them to call 10 CEOs and hear it directly from them. And if we're doing what we're supposed to be doing and trying to do, those CEOs will reiterate that we're really good partners. And that matters a lot to those family and founder-owned businesses, right? They've created something. They don't want somebody coming in and, you know, immediately destroying or doing something different to what they created.
Absolutely. That's the biggest concern we hear all the time. It's their legacy. And how is that going to be protected? Well, thank you so much for a great conversation, Scott.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. I appreciate it.
Likewise. I'm Nikita Sathiraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.